This is an interview with Lynette Kelly for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas, and the date is April 4th, 2014. Thanks very much for talking with us today. Could we start with maybe a little bit about your personal background, your undergraduate and graduate education?
Sure. And thanks very much for including me in the interview oral history project. So I guess I start with, I was born in Lafayette, Louisiana, but raised for nearly all of my life in Omaha, Nebraska. So I'm an avid Nebraska football fan and still have family that live in Nebraska. I went to the University of Nebraska at Lincoln and studied urban studies, which was a cross-departmental major within the College of Architecture, Civil Engineering, Political Science, and other liberal arts disciplines. So that was in the late 70s, and so it was sort of that time when colleges really offered different majors and different courses of study to really take advantage of, you know, different interests or different areas of expertise. So I was really fortunate to have what I think was a really great grounding in lots of public policy decisions. Very interested in urban design, urban planning. Had an internship with the Omaha City Planning Department, and which I thought was just fascinating. Really gelled for me my interests in urban planning, in finance, politics, and all of the public policy issues that surround that. I then, after graduation in 1981, got a scholarship to attend Tulane University School of Law in New Orleans. So was very interested in going back to Louisiana, or actually getting out of Nebraska for the continuation of my education. There was a particular professor there who was exceptionally prominent in the areas of municipal finance and was very lucky to be his student and got a lot of great information, great, just really, I think I would describe it as a nice meld with the practical world versus the academia. In the world of public finance.
Had you been thinking about doing that from your experience at Nebraska?
A little bit. When I went to law school, it was almost, I knew what I didn't want. I didn't want a career that was adversarial. I didn't want a career or working on issues that spanned years and years and years, like some litigation issues. I wanted to have a career that where something was built. I wanted a tangible evidence of what I was working on. I wanted a career where, by and large, it was a very cooperative, goal-oriented working group kind of arrangement where people got together, the issuer decided on the project, people got together to figure out the best way to make it happen, and 3-4 years down the road, you drive past and you see the school. Or the hospital, or the roads. And so I think it was probably a very natural progression that I found myself interested in public finance. But I'm not, I don't think I was that either wise about the different options or that calculating. But I'm very fortunate that it all sort of pointed in that direction.
So then by the time you were finishing law school then, and you got your JD in 84, I see, you had basically decided that that was the direction you were going in from your experience with, what was the professor's name again?
David Gelfand.
Right.
Absolutely. I had a summer experience at the law firm of Cutac Rock and a very preeminent municipal finance firm. And during that summer, I got just a little bit of a taste, an inkling of what a career in public finance on the legal side would entail, and got the bug. And after law school, got a job at Mudge Rose, Guthrie, Alexander, and Verdun, a firm that doesn't exist anymore, but certainly at the time was considered to be the preeminent municipal bond firm in the country. Municipal finance law and law firm life was very different in 1984 than it is today. But the kinds of work opportunities and the different sectors that I was able to work in while at Mudros was just phenomenal. And again, part luck, part planning, but really ended up in the right place, in the right field, in the right career for me.
So what sorts of things were you working on there?
Oh, wow. That's a long time ago. I think I have Alzheimer's.
Was it bond counsel or was it something?
Well, you know, primarily underwriters' counsel work, okay. To tell you the truth. Probably maybe a third bond counsel, two-thirds underwriters' counsel, but in all sectors. As a young associate, I probably really didn't have a clear view of how all the different pieces fit together. But doing bits and pieces of different kinds of transactions, I remember a lot of due diligence trips. I remember a lot of state authority meetings or city council meetings, lots of drafting, lots of documents, and certainly before the days of desktop computers. So probably 3-4 years before that a technological transformation really happened to the law firm environment. So I remember lots of hand marking up documents and 200-page bond resolutions and trying to figure out how the different pieces work together. I remember lots of long nights at the printer, lots of weekends. But it was baptism by fire and really got an opportunity to work really hard, but learned from the best. And again, feel very fortunate that I had that opportunity.
There were some big changes around this time in the municipal bond market and the regulation, of course, the 1986 Tax Reform Act.
Right.
But maybe you could tell us a little about how it was different at that time and what sorts of changes were going on.
Sure. So I started in 1984. I think one of the biggest changes had been that the largest issuers, the most complicated transactions were generally handled by a handful of large New York firms. Clients were clients for life. There was a significant amount of loyalty. I would say face-to-face meetings were still happening a lot more than conference calls. Certainly, there was much more of a direct relationship with your clients and a real history and real friendships. So I think that from the personal relationship level, it was very different back then. Over the last 30 years, I mean, we've certainly seen a lot more movement of bond counsel work to the larger regional firms, and they have developed, you know, an incredible expertise in public finance. And that's due to lots of reasons, political reasons, reasons that you want to give the business to people that are located in your state, the expertise that those firms have been building up. So that's a big change. The second big change is, you know, a lot of this is about cost. And so as with all procurement contracts for state and local governments, I mean, cost is a big factor. So sometimes it's not necessarily considered to be a very lucrative practice in some law firms. And so some law firms have gotten out of the business or devoted fewer resources, maybe allowing the smaller regional firms who possibly can quote a lower rate for some of their work. So lots of reasons why there's been that shift. There's been an incredible reliance on technology, which I think is good for everybody, but it also means that there's a lot more conference calls, a lot fewer face-to-face meetings, a lot less continuity. So you may have been the bond counsel for a particular issuer for the past 35 years. They might be doing a new issue you know, in 6 months, and they might have just picked someone else for any number of reasons. So I think the relationship part of the business has probably suffered because of that.
And then, of course, the regulations, the 86 Tax Act, 15C212,
right.
2 years later.
Very exciting.
Yes. How did that impact the practice?
So I remember very clearly how important it was to finish all of your transactions before midnight at the end of 1985. And so I think that really for 2-3 months, I mean, people were working around the clock, and you really wanted to get those transactions done, obviously, because the new law was coming into effect. Very significant changes. I think that the 94 amendments and the advent of 15C212, I think what the biggest, I think it was a wake-up call for the industry because, number one, somebody was paying attention, which I think was great. It was necessary. It was important. I really commend the SEC for taking a leadership role. But the muni market, because of low default rates, because of the buy and hold nature of a lot of retail investors, it was considered to be a very safe, somewhat sleepy market. And so with these new changes, obviously the market had to adapt, which is not something I think that they were used to, mm-hmm. that we were used to. So the world changes. And I think that the best underwriters and the best lawyers really figured out ways to, you know, incorporate and adapt to the new requirements and still serve their clients well. But there was no question that it was a different era.
And so did you stay then where you were until you went, I see you went to the Municipal Assistance Corporation?
Right. I was really, again, I look back at my career and I think that I've been really one of the most fortunate people to have had the opportunities I've had. But it was somewhat random, actually. I was at Mudge Rose, took some time off when my son was born, and I was able to sort of be a full-time mom for a couple years. Then I went back to some people from Mudge Rose had started the New York office of Orrick Herrington, again, a tremendously successful municipal finance firm. When I went back to work, I joined them at Orrick Herrington, and again, working in municipal finance with some of the very best, so I was really able to learn from the best. One of our clients was the Municipal Assistance Corporation for the City of New York, and I think everyone knows that MAC was really the very first example of when a state had to step in and help a local government in distress. That local government obviously was New York City. Fast forward many, many years, and the infrastructure put in place for New York City as a result of the financial crisis really has served it well. So New York City has, you know, amazing controls, amazing financial stewardship, and really talented people, you know, that run their public finance area. So they were looking for a general counsel. I had familiarity with the folks there and was selected and really had, I think, a couple real takeaways. One was just really taking all of the experiences I've had. And as a general counsel, obviously you have to know, in this case, public finance law, but you also had to use your judgment about any number of things. So I think I grew as a leader and as a person tenfold because I had that, was given that opportunity to serve as a general counsel. The second piece was our board of directors was comprised of really the most senior, most well-regarded people within the public finance community, within the city of New York, within the government structure. And I had the opportunity really for the first time to work closely with the board of directors. And it was eye-opening. And it's something that has really served me well as I work with our board of directors here at the MSRB. The seriousness with which they took their responsibilities, the oversight role, the very difficult policy decisions that were made, you know, I was able to really see that from the inside out. So again, a huge opportunity and great learning experience for me. And then as I look at all of the different financial control boards or different kinds of oversight entities that various states have employed for distressed communities throughout the country, in many cases, they look very much like MAC because it was a model that worked very, very well. So I'm quite familiar with that structure. I think it's very important to have that opportunity, but it's certainly fraught with lots of political issues, you know, sort of taking away some of the authority of elected officials. So, but again, just a really interesting, interesting, innovative, creative, and necessary way to deal with some of these tough issues.
What were some of the main activities and issues at MAC 15 years after the initial crisis?
I remember working on the School Construction Authority, which is where some of the money went for MAC bonds. We did a fair amount of refundings of existing debt. A decision was made around that time that MAC would go out of business, that once the MAC debt was retired, MAC would cease to exist. And a lot of authorities are created for a particular purpose with the stated intent that they will go away when their mission has been accomplished. And that rarely, rarely happens. You know, an infrastructure is built up, you know, there's for lots of reasons. But MAC, a decision was made that MAC would not issue new debt after the couple bond deals that we did when I was there, that MAC would go away when their existing debt was retired. And I remember going to the closing event, and it was, you know, quite a celebration because it existed for a very important person. It exceeded every expectation. It accomplished its mandate, and it went away as it was supposed to. So I think that that's a good lesson. I mean, I think that oversight boards and financial control boards serve a purpose, but I do feel like they need to be limited in their duration, depending on obviously the different facts and circumstances.
So you were there until 93, and I guess it did in fact go out of business.
Not in 93,
not later. It was, when was it? 96, 97, somewhere in there?
You know, I'm trying to think. I think it was maybe in early 2000.
Was it?
But I'm not sure.
Right.
I'm not sure.
So you yourself went on then to Brown & Wood.
Right. Uh-huh. Brown & Wood was the bond counsel for the city of New York. And in my capacity as the general counsel of MAC, I obviously dealt with all of the New York City and New York State officials. So I had a lot of familiarity with them. So I went to Brown & Wood. I was a mother with a young child. So I was on council basis, I guess is what it's called. But I got the opportunity to work with Frank Robinson, who is, you know, considered just one of the deans of the public finance bar. Some of the other partners at Brown & Wood, again, just phenomenal experts in what they do. And some of the clients that I worked on included the Commonwealth of Virginia, Fairfax County, Virginia. I worked on several bond banks, which, you know, smaller governments pool their loans and issues are done at the state level. So it allowed me to have a very different perspective working with very small local governments. So had, again, just additional kinds of expertise because the client base was different. Mostly
is
bond council work.
Similar to what was happening in Orange County, or is it a totally separate structure?
Totally separate. Right. A bond bank structure is where the Virginia Public School Authority. So they would issue bonds instead of, you know, each little county or each little school district issuing $500,000 in bonds. It would be issued at the state level, so you would get a better rating, better efficiencies, and then the proceeds would be loaned to these local governments. But still, diligence, documentation, a real understanding of the project's tax issues, you know, and the like. So I feel like having worked at an issuer, having worked as an attorney, but representing all the different facets of the business, I feel, and then went to the Bond Market Association, which was an advocacy group representing the interests of the dealer community. I feel like I'm one of the few people who really have had opportunities to immerse themselves and really understand all of the different issues that come to bear during a bond transaction, issues that dealers face, issues that municipal issuers face. Obviously, there are a lot of different stakeholders in a transaction. So I think I have a very unique perspective given the background that I have.
So you would have seen the growth of, well, first the missile system and then the NERMSER system.
Yes.
From that side.
Painfully.
Yes, tell me a little bit about that, how that looked from the issuer side,
the underwriter side. Well, you know, I think you have to remember, and I'm looking at you and you don't seem old enough, but I am. But you have to remember that most business was done paper-based. Gosh, at one point, you know, we didn't even have laser printers. So, so there's been a huge technological advance. So I think most people thought it's a good idea to ask issuers to file ongoing disclosures. The policy issues, the rationale made perfect sense. I think issuers might take have an issue with that or, have a different perspective. But I think for the well-functioning of the market, it made perfect sense. I think the execution was probably the best they could do at the time, but it didn't work. So the NERMSER system was a decentralized, paper-based, private sector business where issuers would, FedEx their documents or mail their documents in without any indexing. The NERMSERs themselves would index the documents. Some did a better job than others. It was impossible, actually, to know that, we do know that there was not a consistent collection amongst all of the NERMSERs. We know that the indexing was different at each of the NERMSERs, and we know that there were significant mistakes. Vermont was filed under Virginia. I mean, it's a very complicated system with over 50,000 different municipal issuers. So that is a very complicated system. The NERMSERs probably did as best they could, given the complexities of the market. But it is, I think, fast forward to the creation of the Muni Council, and then ultimately to the MSRB's building of the EMIS system. I think with that experience, it was people in the business understood that the NERMSER system didn't work. But there was no technology at the time that would have created those efficiencies that EMMA does now. There was not a sense about who would pay for this. So to have a private sector company pay for it or to run it, it was hard to figure out who was going to fund it. There were lots of issues that just made it very, very complicated, even though people, I think, were went in it with all of the right for all of the right reasons.
Was it? Were you in the position where essentially you were one of the people who were helping issuers get the disclosure correct in this period of change?
In some cases, we had issuer clients who asked for our help to craft their disclosures and to file their disclosures. Some of the more sophisticated issuers did that internally. Some asked or relied on their financial advisor for help, not their bond counsel. So I have had experience doing that. And I remember very clearly that you'd get all the FedExes together and you'd send them out and you would keep evidence so that, you know, if there was ever a problem, you would have evidence that something was filed, but you really had no idea what was going to happen on the other end.
And was the new pay-to-play regulation rule, G37, was that something that came across your desk, so to speak?
You know, well, obviously, when you're an attorney at any of these bond counsel firms, you have to be very aware of new regulations and the like. And I do remember there was a fair amount of, you know, real-time education about either tax law changes or Rule 15, C212, you know, and anything new coming up, even things at the state level sometimes. G37 would have absolutely impacted the dealer community. So I know that in-house lawyers, in-house compliance experts were very busy implementing policies and procedures, training, documentation to implement the new pay-to-play restrictions. So I think that the main burden fell on those folks. There were also probably external law firms that were experts in federal election campaign issues or you know, broker-dealer regulations. So they were probably called upon to help implement these policies and procedures. As an underwriter's counsel, though, on a particular transaction, it would not necessarily have been something that I would have dealt with hands-on, but we were all very aware of the change. Lawyers were hit up for campaign contributions in the same way that broker-dealers were. Frankly, everyone in the industry was hit up. And it was really a practice that evolved over time. Maybe there were, you know, plenty of innocent requests for contributions or whatever, but it certainly was a practice that reflected very poorly on the integrity of this market. In some instances, it was very clear that you don't get in the door unless you've made a significant political contribution. And that's just not the way, you know, you want people to feel like the market is fair and transparent. People get the work based on their ability, not based on a political contribution. So it was radical because, of course, it certainly has issues with, you know, free speech, political contributions, and the like. It was challenged legally, you know, in court. But I so commend the MSRB for taking a leadership position. You may know that MSRB Rule G37 was the very first pay-to-play rule in the federal securities laws, but it is one that has been copied by the SEC for their investment advisor rule, by the CFTC, by other regulators. So the very small, very focused MSRB was really the leader in pay-to-play rulemaking, and it is something that I think this organization is incredibly proud of, as we should be.
Okay, I want to come back to the question of consultants, because I know that that became controversial a little later on.
Right.
But first, why don't we discuss how you got to the Bond Market Association?
Sure, sure. Wow. Again, short-term memory problems. I was recruited to go to the Bond Market Association. They were looking for someone to run their municipal securities division. The Bond Market Association was the advocacy group for dealer interests in fixed income. So they dealt with corporate bonds, treasury securities, mortgage-backed securities, the repo market, and municipal securities. So they were looking for someone to run their municipal securities activities. I sort of had the right resume. I was intrigued because when you work as an attorney on transactions, you're really working on the front end of the deal. You know, you're putting the financing together, working with the working group and the issuer. You're getting the bonds issued, but you really then move on to the next deal. You really don't have the experience of knowing, well, what happens to the, you know, what happens after the fact. What is secondary market trading like? What is the impact of secondary market trading on the issuer or, you know, a new issue of bonds coming up? What are the issues relating to how much capital a firm might want to commit to holding bonds in inventory? I mean, clearance issues, settlement issues, it's probably, from what we do now, it's sort of not the second half. It's so much bigger than really just bringing the deal to market, and very, very complex. So the intriguing part of the Bond Market Association opportunity was that I would be immersed in the totality of issues facing dealers in the municipal market. So not only all the front-end stuff, pay-to-play rules, syndicate rules, relationships with their clients, with their issuers, but also a tremendous amount of issues for the back end. And I thought that was fascinating because I realized that while I had great training on transactional work, I didn't really have a clear understanding of compliance issues and ongoing issues that impact the dealer community. So again, I felt like it was just the next logical step in really having a grounding in the totality of municipal finance issues.
Okay, so when you got there, what was on the table? Were there hot issues?
Well, I think the first issue was really trying to get a sense of what the priorities were of the dealer community. So at that time, and I think it's true now, each of the heads of the SIFMA membership, which comprised, you know, 90-some percent of all the municipal finance dealers, so all of the big New York firms, many very significant regional firms, and a number of smaller broker-dealer firms, but the heads of underwriting, the heads of sales and trading, the heads of investment banking, these were the leaders in the municipal finance business. And we would have meetings, and everybody would come. And these were fierce competitors, but very committed to this market. I think one thing to remember is people could make a lot more money in other parts of the securities industry, but people in municipal finance were there for the right reasons. They cared about government, they cared about infrastructure, they cared about local government decision making, public policy. I mean, they were really there for the right reasons. So you would have these meetings of 25 people, each of whom were running, you know, multi-million-dollar businesses, and as competitors, but really sitting around the room and talking collectively about this market and what are some of the issues in this market? What are some of the challenges? What can we, what should we be focused on? And I think there was a misperception that an advocacy group just pushes back and tries to stop any regulation or any change or any new developments in the market, and I couldn't have discovered anything less true. I thought these people really were incredibly constructive, and when there were proposed regulations, the reaction was not do everything you can to stop this. The reaction was, well, the public policy that this is a problem. It makes sense. Let's figure out the best way to solve the problem, but in a way that is the most, if you look at cost benefit, you know, the most cost effective. It was just a very constructive, very cooperative process back and forth.
They didn't want to suppress activities that were on the whole healthy.
No. And I think that they, I mean, you know, if you talk to the people around that table about a pay-to-play rule, I think everyone, I wasn't there at the time, but I would imagine every single person said, this is a problem and we need to support the MSRB. And let's look at the words on the page. Let's look, you know, let's make sure that there are no unintended consequences. So I found my experience at the Bond Market Association so eye-opening, and I was so proud to be a part of this business because I really felt like the leaders in this marketplace were very constructive and, again, really wanted what was best for the market. So there were any number of operational issues. We looked at issues like, could there be standard documentation so that if you use a standard agreement among underwriters or selling group agreement, that everybody would be in the industry would be on the same page about what does the document say, how should people conduct their business, how does it work. So not so sexy, maybe, but certainly hugely important, because you want the standardization really creates significant efficiencies in the market. I think I have probably, you know, files and files and files about all the different things we worked on. We tried to do a lot of, really made sure that the regulators in Washington really had access and knew the business people so that there could be real communication between people on the ground doing the business and the people writing the regulations. So there was a fair amount of, you know, let's make sure that there's a healthy, constructive dialogue. So that was really innovative. I think that when I was at the Bond Market Association, we created what's called the Muni Council, and that was the precursor to EMMA. What we did is we got representatives from all the municipal market stakeholders, issuers, investors, the lawyers, the advisors, the buy side, the dealers, of course, really everyone who participated in this market. And we really tried to tackle the issue of the NRMSRs because it wasn't working. Technology had just rapidly advanced to the point where we might be able to come up with a system where there was a central location for all of these disclosure documents, where access could be for free. Access could be, you know, from a desktop anywhere in the world. It was really a vision. Lots of issues still, but this group met for years and really putting together in an incredibly cooperative manner, putting together a framework for what it would look like for a central repository.
Now, Ernie Alonzo was mentioning to me that MSRB was only on the Muni Council itself for, it continued to consult with it, of course, but mm-hmm. that it only was part of it for a couple of years. Is that correct?
Really for about a year. It was the MSRB that brought the group together. It was the group itself, though, that determined that there might be more open, more free conversation without a regulator in the room. So the group continued many years thereafter without the MSRB. But then the conversation then really started to turn towards what would a central repository of documents in the municipal market look like.
And the first step was the central post office?
That's right, yeah. Exactly, the CPO. There were some incredible leaders during that time period. First and foremost, an organization in Texas called the Municipal Advisory Council in Texas. It was a state-run information repository, so they had a significant amount of experience being the repository and clearinghouse for a significant amount of financial information for issuers in the state of Texas. They stepped up and developed the central post office for free. So it was the first time ever that issuers, instead of filing to all of the NRMSRs, they would file to the single portal, and then from that portal, the documents would be sent to the NRMSRs. And the big difference is that the issuers themselves were asked to index and categorize what they were filing. So when you have the creator of the document filling out the information and information about indexing or what kind of transaction this is, the data quality goes up exponentially. So not only did we were we able to ensure that all of the NURMSers got every document, we also were able to ensure that they got the indexing information directly from the issuer. So that was absolutely a huge interim step, very important, but it also the quality of information in the existing NURMSer system exponentially better. By that point, I think we were down to 3 NURMSers. We had started, I think, with 9 private companies wanting to get into that business. I think pretty early on, they realized how expensive it was, how cumbersome, how difficult. And so slowly, folks started getting out of the business.
So in your time at the TBMA, was this the first time that you had to... I guess, was this the first time that things like yield burning, later bond bid rigging, Miami and San Diego,
yeah, sure.
things like the controversies came onto your radar?
Well, I think it was probably just a continuation of more focus on the municipal market. So, of course, you had Orange County, you had... was earlier on in my career. So you had some very high-profile issues, defaults or near defaults. And I think it also was a time where the media became a lot more interested. And remember, for the first time ever, documentation became available. So maybe taxpayers, maybe academics, maybe the media, maybe there was more access to information. So there was a steadily increasing focus on the market. And again, from the newspapers, from the regulators, from enforcement agencies, even from state attorneys general. So again, a continuation of, you know, a lot more focus on the market. I think most people thought that was great. I think that there was some frustration that... and you hear it today, too. You know, you can't open the paper without hearing about Detroit and all the problems. But the reality is that, you know, 98% or whatever, you know, some astronomical percentage of municipal bond deals operate exactly as intended. The issuer gets access to low-cost capital. Investors are very happy with tax-exempt income. The market works great. The bond proceeds are used as intended, but that's not an interesting headline. So sometimes, and it's true with Capitol Hill, it's true with, you know, some focus that, you know, when you're focusing on, you know, the outliers, you know, it's important to remember that in general, the market works exceptionally well.
So there were also more complex products in this time, mm-hmm. derivatives,
right.
auction rate securities.
Right,
and so
sure.
Could you tell me a little bit about your perspective on that?
Well, you know, at that point, you know, we monitored, or wherever I was, you know, you had to be very aware of new products and new structures. So there were tender option bond programs, certainly different kinds of... products, the spiders and the, you know, every product had an acronym, auction rate securities, of course. I think it's, some people don't know this, but so many innovations that we see in the broader financial markets had their roots in the municipal market. So securitization, really that was really started in the municipal market. So, it is a very, very innovative market. The people in this market are wickedly smart and innovative, and you have to be because you're dealing with 50 different states, 50 different state laws, 50 different state constitutions, laws and ordinances at the local level. So every deal, there's no such thing as a cookie cutter deal. Every deal is very unique to the needs and the legal issues for that particular jurisdiction. So you know, if you need, so given that, you know, people have to be very innovative. So, so I guess I would say, I think that the auction rate securities, for example, you know, they certainly served a purpose. I think that the problem was, is that there was not a clear understanding of whether or not the dealer would be providing liquidity and, or the stress situations, and there were not enough, not enough disclosure about what would happen if rates moved in one direction or the next, or if you couldn't get, you know, enough buyers on the reset dates. So there were, of course, it's like anything, right? It works great until it doesn't. And so I think that the expectations or the lack of clarity was a real problem. I think that there are plenty of examples where there were misleading disclosures from the dealers to the issuers and to the investors. Some customer statements actually listed auction rate securities as cash equivalents, which means that they're immediately able to be liquidated. That obviously wasn't the case. So I think that the system worked as it should. There were issues, there were problems, there were, these issues were brought to, you know, the attention of the state and the federal regulators. There were a significant number of settlements. Investors were made whole to some extent. I mean, I think it's a good lesson to really understand what you are doing. I think the same thing with derivatives. I think they're an incredibly useful tool for people that understand what they're doing. I think that they were oversold. They were sold with less than complete disclosures, and they were sold to issuers who probably were not in a position to withstand different, you know, significant rate increases or decreases. So what you've seen, though, is a reaction to those crises, both with the SEC and the MSRB. So not only in terms of enforcement actions, but you've seen a lot of rules now. Our G17 rule now requires dealers to make certain disclosures to their issuers. All the risks of the transaction, what is their legal relationship to the issuer, how are they getting compensated, so that the issuer really has the totality of information for which to make a good decision. I think that there's another, I think it's important to remember that the dealer is not the guarantor of the transactions. I mean, if there's, you know, if they're misleading the issuer, if there's, you know, illegality, if there's, you know, corruption, I mean, those are all obviously criminal activities or actionable rule violations. But issuers are entitled to make a bad decision, and they do sometimes. But it's incumbent upon the dealer to make sure that they have all of the information necessary. And so that wasn't necessarily the case 15 years ago, but it is very much now. So the compliance function, and to make sure that you have documented all of the different disclosures you're making to the issuer, really making sure that the training of your investment bankers is, you know, at the very highest levels. So I think that the caliber of that relationship, the quality, has been much more, it's gone from being sort of more friendly, hey Joe, how are you doing, to, you know, a lot of disclosures. You know, do you understand what this transaction is or what this new product is? You have to go sometimes to the highest elected official or very senior people within the state or local government to make sure that you have appropriate sign-offs. So there are a lot more safeguards put in place because of these issues. Derivatives and auction rate, different issues that have been in the market.
Okay, so I think we'll try and get into the shift over to MSRB, but there would have been a couple of issues, I guess, where you'd have an interesting perspective on either side of that divide. First, the consultants and the decision to amend G38 to ban them.
Right.
Kit Taylor was telling me a little bit about this a couple days ago, but we
left
it on a bit of a cliffhanger because we were getting ahead of ourselves.
Right.
And then, of course, the current issue of the day, the municipal advisors.
Sure.
So why don't we just...
I'm going to, you know, Kit is the expert on that, and he was certainly in the thick of things during all those conversations. It's complicated. And, you know, we are currently working on a pay-to-play type rule for municipal advisors, and all of these issues come up again. We are approaching the 25th anniversary of pay-to-play, 20th anniversary? 20th anniversary of the pay-to-play rule. So we plan over the next year to take a really comprehensive look at that rule. There's been recent court decisions. There's been a lot of other pay-to-play regimes in other markets. So it's certainly time to look at that rule, what works, what needs to be updated, how we can give appropriate guidance to the dealers. And then, of course, at the same time, constructing a rule for municipal advisors that take into account their unique fiduciary duty that they have to their issuer clients. So there are definite differences between municipal advisors and dealers, and the rules obviously have to reflect those differences.
Now, on the consultants, of course, TBMA was against, and then SIFMA, of course, was against the ban. Sorry?
I think that's right.
Yes.
You know, I have to go back to my records. I'm not sure it was... I'm just trying to rack my brain. I do remember... I think I probably wrote the comment letter. I think that the consensus of the group at that time was that there isn't a clear connection between consultants and the making of campaign contributions, and that consultants in some areas or in some ways provide an appropriate level of service to the dealer, but... gosh, let me just refer you to Kit on that.
All right.
Thanks.
Okay, so why don't we talk then about your coming over here to MSRB? Of course, Kit had been here for 29 years.
Right.
So it was
a big transition.
Yeah,
a tough act to follow. At the time, when I mentioned sort of the leaders in the industry who were the folks on the Municipal Executive Committee at the Bond Market Association, those are the same people who serve on the MSRB Board of Directors. Leaders in the industry, people with high ethical standards. And so when they were recruiting for a new executive director, I was a known quantity. I had been living in New York. I had no desire to move to Washington. I certainly was very interested in who they were going to pick, but I was not interested at all. And then got a steady stream of phone calls from people, you know, you should think about this. You'd be really good at this. And again, Kit's a tough act to follow. I got a call from the headhunter that they had retained from Korn Ferry. And every phone call, I got just a little bit more interested, a little bit more. I mean, I think it was really a period of maybe 6 months where I went from, you know, not the least bit interested to being very, very interested. Started interviewing with the headhunter. I think that there were many, many incredibly qualified people. Met with the board of directors or the search committee of the board and was offered the position in April or May of 2007 and started in June. So it was a whirlwind. Relocating my family and moving to D.C. is complicated, but I've been here since June 2007. I feel pinch myself every day to have this opportunity to work at the MSRB with an amazing, dedicated, smart group of colleagues and really be in a position to impact the market in a very positive way.
Can you tell me, we're probably a little bit pressed for time, so okay. We might be skipping too much, but Dodd-Frank is obviously the huge watershed. So tell me a little bit about the run-up to that and then the aftermath.
Sure. I would say, yeah, there were a few different, when I look back at my time here, I mean, I really feel very proud of, you know, certain initiatives and activities. But Dodd-Frank, I think, was really a significant turning point in the history of the MSRB. We had previously only had the responsibility to regulate dealer activity. And under Dodd-Frank, we now have the responsibility to create a regulatory framework for municipal advisors. These folks were previously unregulated. So it is such a rare opportunity to create something from whole cloth. And a system that works for a very diverse group of professionals, a very unique group, people with a very, very specialized skill set. And so how do you follow the congressional mandate in Dodd-Frank and create a regulatory structure without having people leave the business, without it being unduly burdensome? So it's a very delicate balance, and not many people have that opportunity, and we do here at the MSRB, so we are taking it very, very seriously.
I've been told that people have given you quite a lot of credit for getting Emma over the hump at the last gate.
Well, I'll tell you that the Muni Council was the group that conceptualized what Emma would be, but there was no one to pay for it. And when we estimated how much it would cost, it was, you know, millions of dollars every year. So there was no one to pay for it. And then when I got to the MSRB, and at the same time, we had a chairman who also was on the Muni Council, Frank Chin of Citigroup, who is really considered to be one of the very best investment bankers, very best leaders in the industry. Really cares about this industry. And he was really the primary driver. He was able to bring this idea to the MSRB board. He was able to describe it, conceptualize it. He was able to get the board behind the development and the funding of the Emma system. And he is really the person who deserves all the credit. But I can't tell you how exciting it is. It is the only place, the only system in the securities market that combines disclosure documents, primary and secondary, trade data, market statistics, interest rate resets, the entirety of municipal market data in a centralized location available for free. That doesn't exist anywhere, and we are so proud of our system, and it has quickly become so integral to the workings of the municipal market. I mean, it's really, it's just surpassed every expectation that we could have ever had for it.
How is the implementation process? Did that go smoothly? Roughly?
Oh, lots more expensive, a lot more expensive than I thought it would be. It actually, and I have to give Ernie Lanza credit because he was our internal person who really led the development of Emma. We started with a pilot with just primary market disclosure documents. You know, we added other features on slowly. And so it was built and launched in a way that was very systematic, very methodical, a significant amount of training component to it because you've got to train not only the dealers but the issuers because they were filing their secondary market disclosure. Our collection now is almost 5 years old. So we have a help desk and help center. So we're open a significant amount of hours, you know, to take calls in. We can walk people through it. We've got investors. I mean, it's again, surpassed every expectation, mostly because we really thought that only market participants would use Emma. And again, taxpayers, the media, academics. I mean, the number of people who look look at the data in Emma is really staggering. And another thing we have found is that the MSRB and the Emma system has become really a resource for policymakers elsewhere in the federal government as well as state governments. So we will often help a state government, for example, to manage the issuance of debt within their state and to fulfill their oversight responsibilities for the local jurisdictions within their states. So again, really creating a much healthier municipal market. Congressional Budget Office, GAO, other federal government regulators or policymakers, think tanks, we are a tremendous resource to explain how the market works, to show them the data, to analyze the data with them. So we've got a great research area, great data analysts. So it's complicated. But when you base decision-making on data, it's pretty powerful.
Now, I don't think we have anyone else on our interview list who can tell us much about the new version of the SEC Office of Municipal Securities. So perhaps I could nominate you to introduce us.
Well, of course, you know Dodd-Frank required that an Office of Municipal Securities be formed at the SEC and that this office has a direct report to the SEC chair. So again, it's just elevating municipal securities within the SEC to a much higher, much more prominent position. It took a little while for them to get that off the ground, I think because they were really looking for the perfect director of that office. They found that perfect director with John Cross, and he has spent the last year really building an exceptional team of professionals within that office. So their first task was the promulgation of the Municipal Advisor Registration Rule. Very complicated, over 750 pages, and again, controversial, complicated, and they've done a nice job of trying to provide clarity on some of those issues where they can. The SEC last year put out a report on the municipal securities market, and there are a significant number of recommendations that the SEC commission put forth. And so John is looking at that and looking at, you know, ways to implement some of those suggestions. And they are also responsible for overseeing the activities of MSRB rulemaking. You might know that all of our rules have to be proposed rules have to be approved by the SEC. So they are primarily responsible for that. So it's been great. We have the chairman of the SEC come speak to our board every year. She's very interested, as have other SEC chairs. So it's really, I think we're in a sweet spot. We get a lot of attention. The market is acknowledged to be hugely important, very worthy of focus and attention and resources. And so I think that the partnership between SEC and MSRB with other regulators who care about the market, I mean, I think it's in a very, very healthy position right now.
Okay, I know our time is limited and we're coming up to the end of it. So I guess I'll just ask if you have anything else to add before we conclude.
Well, I guess I would, when I look back at my tenure, I think that the MSRB is just run very efficiently. We are good stewards of the resources that the industry has entrusted to us. I have phenomenal colleagues. We're about 110 people, which by Washington regulatory standards is tiny, tiny. But the amount of exceptional work that comes out of this organization is something that I'm very proud of. Obviously, Emma is the signature, the highlight of my career here, and I couldn't be more proud of that. And we have big plans for Emma. It's a utility, and the opportunity to add more functionality and more products and things is really limitless. So look for Emma to continue to be a resource for folks. Another thing that I'm very proud of is our short system. We are the first regulator to actually make available interest rate resets on the short-term part of the market. So another example of where innovation in the municipal market leads other markets by far. Obviously, we talked about municipal advisor regulation and doing that right. And it's difficult. Lots of issues, but we're moving methodically and responsibly and really trying to get as much industry input as we can. Another thing I would just highlight is that I think our relationships with the agencies, the regulators that enforce MSRB rules. So you might know that we write the rules, but FINRA, the Federal Reserve, FDIC, and the Comptroller of the Currency actually enforce our rules for their members or their banks. And so it requires incredibly close coordination, and we provide a very significant amount of support to make sure that our rules are enforced vigorously and appropriately. I don't think I have anything else to add. We're really excited that as we approach our 40th anniversary next year, that we are working with the SEC Historical Society on the municipal securities programming at the Historical Society. We think it's hugely important. We think there's a treasure trove of history in our market, so we're very excited about making that available to everyone.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.